Welcome to Zooming In at the Unpopulist. I'm Landry Ayers. On today's episode, the Unpopulist's editor-in-chief, Shikha Dalmia, and senior editor, Bernie Belvedere, are joined by Matt Iglesias. Matt is a journalist, blogger, and podcaster who's written for The Atlantic and Slate. He's also co-founder of Vox and now writes his daily Substack newsletter, Slow Boring, which is dedicated to realizing a better world through rigorous conversations and a spirit of pragmatism. Matt joins us to discuss the media's adversarial role in politics, how polarization and populism foster conflict, and what both the left and right can do to make sure our politics are more productive moving forward. Enjoy.
Hi, Matt. Great to have you here. Let me get the ball rolling by noting that The Unpopulist was founded to study the rise of neo-authoritarianism, especially of the populist variety that is ascendant on the right at the moment, just as socialism was ascendant on the left after World War II. And in a populist dynamic, one of the strange things that happens is that instead of resisting a tyrant, the people embrace him. They see him as one of them. Yet a liberal polity depends on the people jealously guarding their freedoms and maintaining a posture of skepticism towards political leaders. Now, the other institution that is supposed to hold political power accountable in the liberal scheme is the media, which is supposed to play an adversarial role. How well is the media performing this role right now in this age of populism? Is it even realistic to expect it to do this function, given that we are facing this hyper-negative polarization when each side seems to want to protect its own?
The media has become a very disaggregated force, right? And I think that that's important to understand, because usually whenever people say something about the media, they mean something other than like my personal favorite publications, podcasts, etc. I do think that in the United States, sort of in the Trump era, what we've traditionally thought of as mainstream mass market media has become both very adversarial to right-wing populist politics, but also almost completely ineffectual. I was watching Citizen Kane the other day, classic movie. And, you know, one of the plot points is that Charles Kane, this would-be really left populist authoritarian leader, is having an affair with an opera singer. And that story gets splashed across the front pages. And that's portrayed as completely destroying his career. Whereas today, it's not that there are no damaging scoops reported about the personal conduct of Donald Trump, say, but it doesn't do the kind of damage that historically we would have thought, because the people who are supporters of right-wing populist movements believe that the press is so adversarial that they now don't care what it says, right? So you're not having the efficacy that you would want to. And, you know, you talk about corruption, right? Which is, I think, that the signature weakness of these kind of populist regimes. And Alexei Navalny initially was doing anti-corruption media in Russia. But, you know, you have a situation in the United States where I think if Trump were to become president again, were to start behaving in outrageously corrupt ways, as he to an extent did in his first term, you know, like there were stories in the media about he tried to block Time Warner and AT&T from merging because he was angry at CNN's coverage. This is like a completely outrageous first order abuse of power. It was like a non-story in the Trump years, not because it wasn't reported, but because people didn't care. You know, people who don't like him on broader ideological grounds were not that invested in the details of DOJ management. And right of center, free market oriented people, most of them, they're not interested anymore in what's in the media.
Well, don't even get me started on the indifference of free market. Insufficiently perturbed by Trump. It's to some extent, that's the reason for my existence. But let me push back a little bit on some of what you said. There was a certain kind of Teflon quality to Trump for sure. Like nothing seemed to stick. I do firmly believe it is partly because, you know, of our polarized age a very powerful right-wing media just refuses to play the role it is supposed to play, to the extent that its, you know, normal understanding of journalism has become completely muted. I mean, in India, you know, which I watch very closely since that's where I'm from, there is a phenomenon called Godi media or lapdog media, which is that Modi has essentially put loyalists of his own in every big media house. And they are very much in sync with the regime. They promote the agenda of the regime. They'll put a positive spin on whatever Modi wants to accomplish. You know, there are embarrassing moments of Modi going scuba diving with, you know, this bouquet of peacock feathers recently. And the media just kind of like chased him there and, you know, taped it and dutifully reported it. And I can understand it in India because, you know, the press never really had quite a firm adversarial role. It always did play ball with whoever was in power. It's gone to completely new limits because he actually controls the media houses now. In the US, it has happened completely organically and spontaneously. When the election results were coming out in the December of 2020, Fox News had this very sophisticated predictive program, which allowed it to call the election in Arizona extremely fast before the other networks did. And the Tucker Carlsons of the world went ballistic as to why their own news channel had done that, because they were so in the pocket of a Donald Trump, right? They wanted to wait. There was the big election steal movement that he was pushing at that time. And to some extent, they wanted to be part of it. The producer got fired for calling Arizona. Now, this level of journalistic abdication where, you know, journalists live for a scoop. And instead of being proud of the scoop, journalists within Fox News were baying for the blood of like people who got the scoop. I mean, how do you explain this evolution? How do we understand this?
You know, I think it's striking that, you know, at around this time, right, that there was also a move among some Fox personalities to try to sort of move off of Trump. Some of Rupert Murdoch's papers started promoting Ron DeSantis very heavily. Some of the Fox personnel were saying, you know, Biden won the election fair and square. And they started losing ratings market share to Newsmax and to OANN, at which point Fox pivoted back to supporting Trump on election type stuff. And then they wound up getting sued. You know, and losing in court. And they now have to do this very awkward pivot where they are 99% pro-Trump. But whenever he starts going off about election fraud, they have to cut in because they don't want to be sued again. You said like some of it is like spontaneous from inside the Fox ecosystem. But it's also that Trump supporters seem to have a much more profound and organic relationship to Trump than they do to these intermediary broadcast figures. And this was, I think, evident back in 2015, 2016. Early on, a lot of right-wing media figures were saying that Trump didn't seem that like steeped in the canons of, you know, conservative thought, and he was not the favored figure. But some people were just like, no, like Trump, he's hilarious. He's great. He's a fighter. He's the guy we need. And they benefited in the ratings, you know, and people came to align themselves with Trump, you know, not through coercion of the sort that you see in consolidated, you know, hybrid democracies, but as a kind of a ratings, a business play. There has not been a market niche for, I would say, ideologically rigorous, factual, right of center media content. You know, it hasn't thrived in the marketplace. And I mean, I wonder if there's a personality asymmetry, right? Because there's incredible levels of interest among left-wing media people and their audience in exploring the question, is Joe Biden insufficiently left-wing? Right? Like that's just like always an issue that has traction in the media. People are very suspicious of that. Whereas I don't really hear that about Trump. You know, like when he tries to maybe wriggle away from the conservative stance on abortion. I don't see conservative media becoming like obsessed with the question of, well, is he going to sell us out? Or he's just flip-flopped on TikTok. And again, there's just like not a lot of scrutiny, even on the level of like pure ideology. People just really like Trump.
Right. But that goes to exactly the populist dynamic that I'm talking about, that because the people have such a strong connection with Trump, the media, the right-wing media, thinks that its role is to reflect that connection and strengthen that connection rather than hold Trump accountable. And in the United States, it's doing it entirely voluntarily. The right-wing press is not being told by, you know, anybody in positions of political power to do that, or they'll lose their access to, you know, some important factor of production, as in India. They are doing it voluntarily, which goes to the strength of this populist movement that we are in.
I wonder if we can just sort of stay on the polarization idea just for a sec. I remember, Matt, from your days being associated with the Slate pitch, there's this weird kind of polarization apologia that I sometimes come across that I wanted to get your take on. So the idea is that polarization is at least somewhat good because it means there isn't the word you used was disaggregated. There isn't like a kind of monolithic news environment. And because of that, fewer stories or angles slip through the cracks in a kind of polarized moment. So let me try to sort of unpack the argument and let me know what you think about it. When we ask ourselves what ingredients need to be there for a free and independent and even adversarial media to be able to thrive, first of all, you need protection from state encroachment and censorship. And we get that right off the bat in the First Amendment, right where it lists, it enumerates the freedom of the press. It follows right after freedom of speech in the text, even though, you know, the two aren't materially different provisions. You also need the technology in place that allows for the mass dissemination of news. And we've had that for the longest time with, you know, the printing processes that we've had, and now with various communication technologies turbocharged by the internet. Then you need the market conditions favorable to a robust news industry, which we have with advertising and subscription models on the supply side and other forms of like monetizing your discourse presence or being an influencer or whatever. But I want to focus on the final ingredient because this gets to the heart of the question of polarization. You need a persistent demand for this kind of media. So you need for there to be a market for independent and adversarial media. So if polarization is present in society, it means there's always going to be a large sector within it, no matter which party's in power, that is going to be energized enough or politically active enough to be in sort of ongoing, continual adversarial mode. And they're going to want their news operations to be independent from the venues that they see as towing the dominant party line. So like polarization can maybe ensure us a better media environment. I think this argument is really naive, but I wanted to get your take on it to see like what's wrong about it.
I think that there are strengths and weaknesses of different paradigms. In the United States, if you were looking at the situation in the mid-1960s, you would say, well, we have this kind of fairly oligopolistic media environment, very little levels of polarization, no sense of like the crusading ideological or partisan newsletter. And the result of that is that it was too easy for a time for sort of the powers that be to mislead people about what was going on in Vietnam. And so now we look back and we had this fracturing of the media environment. We had more talk radio. We had the Fairness Doctrine. We had the rise of cable news. And now you can't create that like forced consensus reality. State-led efforts to mislead the mass public are very likely to fail because anything you say will face opposition, will face scrutiny. If anything, that the challenge is persuading people of things that are true, right? Because there's so much incentive to kind of dissent. The problem is that what you wind up with is every issue sort of approximating a kind of like 50-50 dynamic, regardless of what the underlying facts are, right? So it's like, you can't fool all of the people, but you also can't convince all of the people. And the merits of what you're saying wind up having very little to do with what it is people end up believing. And, you know, that's challenging, right? And a big part of it is on the demand side. I mean, you were talking about, you know, the economic conditions for sort of robust independent media. And in the DC area, there's a publication called the Washington Business Journal, and it's for subscribers only. And it's like local news catering to an audience of local business owners and decision makers. It covers a limited range of topics, but it's like really good, but it's also really expensive. And the premise is, like, you might actually care what's happening in local government because it's important to your livelihood, so you should pay for it. So a lot of the stories are a little boring, right? Like, they're framed very non-sensationally. And business press is like that in general. I'm a columnist for Bloomberg Opinion. But, like, my Bloomberg News colleagues, they publish these very rigorous, very factual, but often tedious news articles on the presumption that, like, as a financial decision maker, you actually want to know, like, what's happening with Caterpillar or what's happening with appliance regulations or whatever else. But, you know, most citizens don't engage with the news in that way, right? I mean, we're reading articles primarily for entertainment or for expressive values. And that just does not, you know, encourage anybody to sort of report to you things that are going to be dissonant. You're talking about slate pitches. The classic slate pitch is this person who, all things considered, I think is a bad guy, is actually correct about this specific thing he's saying right now. That's just always unwelcome. People want the bad guys to be wrong about everything. If you ask someone, like, is that true? Is anyone wrong 100% of the time? They're like, no, the world's more complicated than that. But presented with that complexity, it's like the human mind rejects it.
So there's a sense in which a disaggregated, disintermediated, a decentralized media environment can be stomachable if there is enough good faith among the different sectors. When instances of that are possible, that ensures that the epistemic kind of mess that we're in is not completely unbridgeable. And here's where I think populism has a particularly different challenge to it as a political orientation than others in terms of torpedoing the possibility of this kind of a shared media space. So one of populism's abiding traits is its stress on the kind of virtuous folk against the kind of predations of the elites. And if you think about that dynamic, it manifests itself in various ways. So, like, one of those ways is that it expresses an ongoing contempt and at times even vitriol for various gatekeepers in society. In a political context, you've got the quote-unquote establishment. You've got the swamp. You've got the weird phenomenon where a purely descriptive term like beltway is turned into an insult within populist subcultures, right? In a media context, you've got the MSM or mainstream media. Populism needs, in order to fan its flames, an institutional foil to go up against, right? So Trump's infamous enemy of the people stuff comes to mind, but also various figures within the heterodox space, like, say, Brett Weinstein, who are reflexively distrusting of mainstream institutions, including media. Someone like that comes to mind, too. So our situation today is that there's an entire political orientation, populism on the right, that is dependent on being kind of existentially troubled by society's various institutional layers. So I'll give an example and then I'll let you answer this. The way COVID intervention, which was always going to rely on the forms and practices of elite management, things like scientific expertise, bureaucratic control, discourse and opinion gatekeeping, that was always going to be a feature of the way we managed COVID. But that also meant it was always going to be demagogued and distrusted by the kind of right-wing crank machine because it's institutionally presented. So what can the mainstream news industry possibly do to win trust in a context where this group of people just views distrust of elite institutions as a kind of inherently ennobling act?
Well, that's a difficult question. I mean, I'm not exactly sure what you could do. You know, one thing, though, is that I do want to urge decision makers at different media organizations to think about what it is they really want to do. Something that I've noticed in a bunch of places that I have worked over the years is that often the people who cover politics are the most, in part, I think, because they cover politics, are the most balanced in their approach to it. Whereas the people who aren't primarily writing about politics, you know, tend to be very left-wing, right? Like America's theater critics, you know, is like a hyper-left kind of group. And I think that editors don't always consider how seepage of the personal political opinions of like sports writers, food writers, creates an impression of the overall institution as just a kind of like hostile alien type of space. You'll often see this, right? So like the New York Times will hire somebody who's maybe right of center, and then there'll be controversy about it because most of their readers, most of their staff are left of center. And they're like, why do we have this guy? And then the reason is always like, well, we want to be credible with broad audiences. But I feel like having, you know, of Ross Douthat on staff as an opinion columnist buys you very little goodwill in practice. I like his work, but in terms of like making conservatives think the New York Times is good, it doesn't deliver. Whereas like having leftist asides and presuppositions built into coverage that the decision makers probably don't think of as being about politics at all consistently sends to people a message like, this is not for you. And that makes it, you know, that much harder again to sort of be credible in these kinds of spaces. You know, COVID was particularly difficult on many, many different levels, starting with the fact that, you know, the man who was president of the United States at the time just didn't really engage like at all in the question of what was the outcome that he wanted. You know, was like very unclear. And you know, I go back and I run back the tape, and he adopted this like strong anti-lockdown persona only after having imposed one, which came after he sort of gave people a lot of false reassurance. And then somehow his own incredible gyrations on this topic became an example of how you couldn't trust the establishment. And like, you know, the thing that I always want to say to people, I mean, people like Brett Bronson, you know, people who I see engage in this kind of relentless project of like tearing down the so-called experts of the mainstream. And they often like raise good points. But the question is always like, compared to what? Right? I mean, nothing in life is perfect. It's challenging to, you know, make decisions in uncertain frameworks. But I've never found a like alternative source of information that's like actually in a consistent way better than listening to established voices and established, which is not to say, you know, you should listen to anybody blindly, but that's what drives me crazy about the like modern populist mood. It's just not true that if you follow Brett Weinstein's Twitter feed, you'll get reliable information about these topics. People instead, they just flit around and adopt the kind of, you know, confrontational posture of the moment. And yeah, I've got a 9-year-old, and I associate a lot of this with like childish behavior. Kids, like, they don't like to be told what to do, which like I get and I empathize with, but like you can't listen to them.
Yeah, a lot of good points there, Matt. But I'm wondering, you know, what you described as the internal newsroom, news culture dynamic in, say, the New York Times, where the political journalists are, you know, in it for a very different reason than the app makers and the developers, you know, who go there for, you know, they leave their high-paying jobs at Amazon or Google or what have you, and they go into a news industry because they are ideological. They want to be doing good. And they realize, well, the political journalists over there are just trying to get it right. You know, they want to do good too, but they are also trying to get it right. And it leads to this kind of like a weird dynamic and internal conflict and tension, you know, in the New York Times, where the reaction to a Tom Cotton op-ed, you know, from the non-news staff is stronger than the news staff, right? And it, I mean, but to me,
it suggests that there is still like a fundamental divide right now between the liberal press, which is biased, but trying to get things right, versus the right-wing press, which wears its biases on its sleeve and is proud of them. So, you know, there can be potentially a corrective to the liberal biases of a New York Times that it'll never get any credit for. But there is no corrective in the, you know, right-wing media universe because it's so fully captured by this populist moment that we are in, which is reflected in our politics too, right? Republicans have no interest in transactional politics anymore. And I mean, and I say this as somebody who comes from the center right and never voted Democrat till Trump came along. So, I mean, how do you correct this? You know, so there is something asymmetrical over here. And how do you get to it?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, right? I mean, it seems like part of what has happened is that, you know, a disposition toward liberalism has always been a somewhat minority persuasion in the public, but a disproportionately elite persuasion that exerted, you know, kind of additional influence and used to be spread across both partisan coalitions. Part of the dynamic is that Trump has sort of expelled right of center liberals from the right of center camp in a way that, you know, can be heartening in some ways, right? But it's created a much more unbalanced political system in which I don't think that a more liberal left of center is like capable of carrying the day on its own. Because people just disagree, right, about all kinds of underlying public policy questions. People disagree about abortion rights, and they disagree about, you know, how Medicare should approach prescription drug pricing. And most people care more about those kind of day-to-day issues. And this alignment of education with partisanship, with liberalism, with cosmopolitan dispositions, you know, makes it really challenging to sort of have both like functioning social institutions, but also to have a safe democratic space, because it, you know, it seems inevitable and natural and correct to have right and left coalitions alternate in power, right? Like that's part of how liberalism works, that we all have our ideas about how things should go, but we also accept that there's going to be overreach and correction and counterbalance, and also that, you know, there's tension always between liberalism and democracy, but that you need to have a democratic system, and that means that people are going to get what they want to some extent, even if their preferences aren't, you know, exactly mine. And so we want to have this kind of discursive political system with a back and forth. And, you know, I mean, I look back on George W. Bush's presidency, which I really disagreed with in really profound ways, and which in some ways did things that were more concretely harmful than anything I saw Donald Trump do. John Kerry went to the people in 2004, and they didn't like what he was selling. And I found that very disappointing and very frustrating and very alarming, but also it was the rules of the game. You know, and Democrats retooled in 2006. They recruited a lot more kind of like rural candidates and moved to the center to an extent on guns, and they won. And then Bush's policies started generating visibly like bad results. And there was a huge move away from him. And that, you know, that feels like politics as it is meant to be practiced. And I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm curious about what you think. You know, it makes me sad when I see Mitt Romney decide that the Republican Party like doesn't work for him anymore. So what he's going to do is he's going to quit the Senate. Like that to me just makes things worse.
Yeah. I mean, on the other hand, it may make it worse, but, you know, Mitt Romney staying in the Senate and being so ineffective is also not a fun
thing. No, yes.
Like, you know, so, but no, I mean, I take your point on all of this, but, you know, and I mean, I sort of see myself a reformist on the center right. Like, I think the forces of cynicism and nihilism have gotten so out of whack on the center right that there needs to be some sort of corrective from within. And I don't think if you have a corrective from without, it's going to work, because that's just going to feed into kind of like the culture war dynamics, right? So if you tell the right, well, you know, you got this cancel culture story wrong, they're just going to turn on you if you're from the left. But I think if somebody, you know, who's from within the right does some fact checking and some correction and says, no, things are not so bad, maybe you have a prayer. That said, I also think that the right is kind of like it's reached some kind of escape velocity. So, I mean, I remember when you were back at Vox, right? I actually think that that's a time when peak wokeness had been reached and there were reform currents within the left pushing back against kind of some of the wokeness in the universities. And I give this example often. Vox ran an anonymous piece by a liberal professor about how his liberal students terrified. You remember that, right?
I do.
Yeah. And I thought it was a great piece. And what was the right's reaction to that? It was not that, okay, you know, these social corrective mechanisms are now kicking in and we are, you know, beginning to make inroads on the excesses of the left. It was to double down on the culture wars. So tomorrow, if cancel culture were to be cut in half or completely disappear, this sort of right-wing, you know, anti-woke universe, because it feeds on itself, it's monetized itself, is going to continue to, you know, lambast on the other side. So I don't know what to do to bring them back to reality and bring them kind of like make them interested in just the basic liberal project again and show them, you know, it has yielded some rather good results.
Yes. I mean, I want to try to get regular people who read things to understand that there is money to be made in keeping you as spun up as possible about everything. And, you know, the dynamic around that piece in Vox, it happens all the time. You'll see that whenever a ostensibly left of center institution makes some gesture of reasonableness, there's a lot of pressure among people on the right to like reject it. To like say that that didn't happen, or to, if I say something, you know, people who don't like know that much about me, but they like saw me tweet some positive things about Joe Biden in the morning, and then in the afternoon, I'm like, I think it's bad when people commit crimes. They'll be like, well, where were you on that? They don't like ask themselves, like, where was I? It's like they want to believe that everyone who's not 100% with them is maximally unreasonable on everything. And that's the mentality, you know, that keeps you kind of in the playground, right? Rather than thinking critically about anything. I remember a very kind of classic argument on the right about liberals is that they will present an exaggerated account of the extent of racism in America in order to generate this kind of very monolithic 90% African-American vote for Democrats, which just like nobody could have that level of consensus about concrete public policy issues. And they're correct on some level, right? I mean, that's like leveraging identity. Like, those people hate you. You have to vote for us, right? Like, don't think about, do you actually agree with us about abortion or whatever? We're the only ones you can trust. And conservatives have started really running that play on this huge swath of predominantly white America. And it requires you to like, just like not ask yourself, like, is it actually true that left of center institutions are as monolithically far left as we are saying? And, you know, people do that for personal gain, that's not analysis, you know, and you need to ask yourself, whatever it is you're reading all the time, but it's like, like, is this true? Like, does somebody just want me to hit retweet on this or give me a little heart? Like, can I kick the tires on this bombastic statement? And I just see constantly, you know, people clearly overstating for effect things that they can't possibly really believe about the state of things. It matters what you say.
I think in such an environment, it can become alluring to think, if you could just level with the American people. They would accept what you're saying, and we would enter into a far more informed and virtuous moment if the news would just sort of stop doing those things that you said, which is sort of reflexively exaggerate the rightness of their position to never cede an inch to the other side. You remember the Vox cards that you guys would come out with and the explainers? I thought this was a great resource for people. But let me bring in Aaron Sorkin here. And I think The West Wing immediately comes to mind when that name is invoked. But I want to ask you a question based on a different Sorkin property, The Newsroom. So the thesis from that show was that if the public were truly leveled with, if genuinely objective news reporting were prominently available to the masses, we'd have not just a more informed citizenry, but a more virtuous citizenry. And the lead character, Will McAvoy, spends the series in anguish over corporate demands, clickbait, shallow coverage, and he thinks doing news, quote, the right way, would have a profound effect on society. Is that hopelessly naive? I mean, why or why not?
It seems a little fantastical, right? I mean, they're delivering an account of a kind of a bygone day when TV news personalities could shape events in a much more profound way than I think is possible right now. But I do think it matters, though, the character and decision-making of people in positions of influence. Like, something that I've seen recently is that a lot of people on the Trumpist right pushing for a federal effort to, you know, either ban TikTok or force ByteDance to divest it. And they've been pushing this for a long time, and it looks like they might get their way out of Congress. They got huge bipartisan vote in support of their position. But then right as action is coming on this, this very important conservative donor who is an owner of TikTok, an investor in TikTok, met with Trump and agreed to give him money. And then Trump flipped his position on this. And that puts people, you know, like Peter Thiel, in this awkward position where, like, Trump has flip-flopped on them. These are rich people with means. They've got their podcasts and whatever else, but also just, you know, they don't need to be media success stories. And, like, they can choose to say to their audiences, like, what happened here, like, I think is bad. Like, I think it reflects poor decision-making, not just act like courtiers, you know, who are like in the true spirit. And so far, I haven't, like, why does liberalism exist at all, right? Like, why don't republics all immediately collapse into authoritarian dictatorships? And it's because the leader's own political coalition includes some level of disagreement about topics, right? To be an effective democratic leader, you need to get a bunch of people to vote for you who don't all agree with each other about everything. And then those people in your coalition don't just trust each other with infinite power. So they want to continue to have electoral institutions, ongoing competition, free media, et cetera, et cetera. And I see people inside the Trump coalition now not responding to their own disagreements in a way that I think would reflect integrity. There are clearly people in the Republican Party who still believe in the benefits of free trade, but they're not saying that. You know, they're not dramatizing to people that I voted for Trump because I thought he was better than the other person, but I think his analysis of this topic is, like, significantly mistaken. And that other people are, like, misleading the public about this. I mean, that must be what they think. It's not possible there was, like, 100% turnaround on, like, a totally classic and slightly boring public policy topic. But people feel that, like, they need to be on side all the time, including people who don't have that much to lose. And, you know, that's very frustrating. You talked about Mitt Romney's lack of, you know, efficacy as a senator. And that's the same kind of thing, right? This is a guy clearly at the tail end of his career. He's a wealthy and successful man. He's got a great family. If he were to have lost a Utah Senate primary, it's, like, not the end of the world for him. And he conveyed, like, via smoke signals to liberals how he felt about things rather than being engaged in a meaningful way that would have made a difference to, you know, like a public of conservative Mormons who live in Utah and who might care what he thinks.
I mean, I completely take your point that populism is not a sustainable long-term governing model because it doesn't have a solution to the problem of disagreement that you mentioned. You know, how do you build coalitions out of people who may be aligned in some ways, but may also have fundamental disagreements? And the populist solution to that is sowing fear, right? Like, and making the cost of disagreement extremely high. That's what Trump has done. And so the first thing that in a populist moment happens is there is a flattening of resistance from within the own party. And Trump has remade the Republican Party in his own image. And the points of resistance that you would expect from the Mitt Romneys of the world, you know, they just kind of get flattened. You know, so that's a big problem right now in the Republican Party. The media has fallen in line. The Republican press has fallen in line. And the reason they have done it is because Trump has a very direct connection with his base and his constituency. It may be diminishing, but it still has, you know, a pretty sizable clout within the right. Even though I'm an optimist and this will burn itself out, you have to prevent it from doing a whole lot of damage here and now. So what should the strategy be? I mean, should we wait it out and let it run its course? But that may take a long time. Or we find ways to expedite its fall. And so, you know, what would be the strategies for that, both politically and in the media?
It's hard to know. I mean, one thing is I want people on the left to be more welcoming of converts, which is not the left's strong suit in terms of these kind of dynamics. I want to encourage, you know, right of center people to fight, to not just assume that it will pass. It's disappointing that the reaction to the 2020 election was this election denial and this Trump comeback. But I do think that, like, if Trump loses in 2024 to Biden, there is another opportunity for Republicans to look themselves in the face and say, like, what happened here? Like, we decided that this guy was a genius because he won in 2016 while losing the popular vote when almost nobody has ever won three presidential elections in a row. Just like, why are we doing this? Because so much of the current populist moment is built off the presupposition that Trump delivers something extraordinarily valuable to the American right. And I just don't think that that's true. Like, analytically, I don't think it holds up to much scrutiny. But if he wins, that will reinforce this kind of false presupposition. Whereas if he loses, that's just another chance for everybody to ask themselves, like, what are we doing here? Like, couldn't John Kasich have just been president for the past 8 years and we'd be getting everything that we want, but also lots of moderate people who are alienated by wokeness or whatever would be saying, yeah, this Kasich guy, he seems sensible. Instead of right now, Trump markets what are in fact just like political downsides and personality deficits as some kind of highly effective means of beating the left. And like that's not true factually. And I don't know what else to say about it other than like him losing is the best evidence that this is not working. Like one of the things he did is like he convinced people that Barack Obama getting reelected in 2012 somehow like proved that conventional conservative politics had completely failed. But meanwhile, you have like Larry Hogan is elected governor of Maryland, Charlie Baker in Massachusetts. Like it's not lots and lots of people can mobilize centrist sane opinion against the excesses of the left. It's like honestly not that hard. The left is not that powerful, actually, not that appealing. And the proven way to beat them and neutralize them is just to put a kind of normal seeming, competent, minimally empathetic person in charge. Because the left's whole calling card, right, is empathy, just like we care. Right. And having an asshole who just conveys the opposite of that about everything is empowering to the left, not disempowering.
So, Matt, I wanted to ask about slow boring. What was the thinking there initially, or how has the thinking developed? What niche in the media universe do you want it to fill? Do you feel like it's successfully filling?
There's a few different things, but one is just, you know, I wanted a niche to say what I think about things without getting yelled at too much by my coworkers. And I also want, you know, something that I think a lot of us do, to do media that's engaged. You know, I try to be both like correct in a way that I think some media outlets get fuzzy and ideological, but also frank about what I think. Like if the point of a piece I write is that you should vote for Joe Biden, like I will just say that instead of trying to like smuggle it in through some weird framing angle. The one legacy of like old neutral media that we've hung on to is that news reporters never say what they mean. And like, I don't think that that has been incredibly constructive, because something I always learned is like a magazine writer, an essay guy, you actually state a thesis in your piece, then you like marshal evidence for it and present an argument. A lot of what happens in journalism now is in this like weird, like tweener space where you don't have a thesis statement, but it's clear that the author is coming from a very kind of biased position. The unpopulist is framed around liberalism. I'm framed more around, I think, the idea of pragmatism, but where it overlaps is pluralism. You know, that you live in a society in which people want to advance their interests through the political system, and which people's preferences and ideas vary. And you're not going to score some kind of like knockout blow where, you know, we like win on a bold agenda and then like all our ideas are enacted and politics ends, right? That's like a very, I think, like a childish way of thinking about politics that a lot of grownups have gotten invested in. Mine is called Slow Boring. It's a reference to Max Weber. But I mean, I think the critical element of liberalism as a disposition is just this recognizing that like we're like living in a society together that has a lot of different people in it, and they think and want different things, and we're trying to navigate that, which involves trying to convince people you're wrong and I'm right, but also, you know, trying to practice like politics is a team sport where you recruit people rather than exile them, where you try to develop solutions that are going to be sustainable rather than based on the idea of like vanquishing our enemy. I try to get people to understand. I mean, I like the new Dune movie that's out in theaters, because I think it's about this in part, right?
I'm the only one who has not watched it.
Okay. But, you know, there's something very seductive about this idea of the messianic savior who leads your people to triumph. But the movie illustrates that it's quite dark, like where that takes you. Like that does not work.
It's interesting. I sort of met you way back when you were in a very different political place. You were much more progressive, and I would even call you radical, and you've kind of like shifted to the center now. And I've actually had a similar evolution. I mean, I've moved much more. I mean, I'm still sort of free enterprise, but much more, you know, towards the center and even the progress, you know, even towards progressivism. So the way I describe myself personally, and Bernie can tell me he describes himself, but I describe myself as essentially a Burkean progressive. So I, you know, want certain, you know, I appreciate certain progressive ideas. I'm still an old-fashioned liberal in that I believe in liberty and equality and, you know, all that good stuff. And I think, you know, there are lots of injustices that still need to be addressed and amended. But the way you do it is through sort of a kind of liberal proceduralism and deliberation, where you talk it out and enact it, and you are not going to do it through radical reforms or by making somehow politics irrelevant to the game. I mean, and I, you know, have a big, big problem with lots of folks on the libertarian right who are kind of anarchists and who somehow think that politics can just be removed from life and you can have some big private, you know, companies to whom you can outsource law enforcement and defense and what have you and live in some kind of a utopia, as if politics is not sort of endogenous to the game, as if you're going to do away with disagreement and, you know, decision making and, you know, all of that just because now you've decided, you know, you're not going to have a government. So So I'm very much kind of, I think, in a similar place to you, Matt, in my old age and you in your middle age.
I think there's a convergence when you start to acknowledge that, like, politics will continue, and also that the contemporary United States of America has its many flaws and many things we could say about it, but it's pretty good. Like, there's not a lot of historical examples of people's lives being better than they are, you know, in the here and now for most of us. And so you said Burkean, right? And that's, you know, that's just like prudence, right? I think in a completely different time or place, I might have a much more sympathetic view toward radicalism. But like, really, in the richest country in human history, we need to overturn everything and like gas people up with the most exaggerated accounts? You know, at a certain point, to me, like, it doesn't make sense. And you need to do a different kind of politics.
Matt, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Yes, likewise, Matt. This was a lot of fun. Really fun.
Thank you for listening to Zooming In, a project of The Unpopulist. For more like this, make sure to subscribe for free at theunpopulist.net. Until next time.